I shared with you last week a story from the life of Stephen Curtis Chapman. Stephen Curtis Chapman's a famous Christian musician, for those of you who aren't familiar with his name. And I shared with you about 10 years ago how the Chapman family lost one of their daughters to a tragic car accident. And we talked about that story in the frame of the discussion last week with loss and moving forward, and how do we as Christians move forward with that loss. You know, losing a child is probably one of the most difficult things that anyone will ever encounter in life. Some of you know that better than others from experience. I'll never forget my aunt and uncle, when I was about 10 years old or so, began trying to have a family. Previously, they had decided that they weren't going to have kids, and for a long time, they didn't have any. My sister and I kind of were their children growing up. And then they decided that they really did want a family, and they began trying, and took a while, and finally got pregnant. But almost immediately, there were problems with that pregnancy. And they knew going into it that this birth, this delivery, the health of this child was in question. Allison Nicole was born in September of 99, and she lived only 5 months until February of the following year. She was born prematurely with all sorts of health complications and all sorts of problems. And the prognosis for her future, if she was to live, was not a very easy future. And tragically, she was lost 5 months later the following year. And I didn't go to see her at the hospital. My parents kept my sister and I back because it was kind of hard to watch. Many of you know what it's like to sit there in front of a child with tubes attached to them and wires and all sorts of things coming off of them to try to keep them alive. But I do remember very vividly that experience. My parents' trips back and forth to the hospital, the prayers that were offered, and the grief that was born after that loss. The grief that still is remembered by my family. You know, they say the most difficult experience a couple will ever go through is losing a child. In fact, the rate of divorce increases dramatically for those who have lost children, because it's hard to lose a loved one in of itself. But it's even more difficult when it's your son or your daughter. And instead of them standing at a casket at your funeral, you're standing at their casket, and you're burying them at a time and a place in your life where you weren't expecting to. And it's a story that gets repeated often throughout history, and it's a story that comes out of Scripture in our passage this morning in Mark chapter 5 with the story of Jairus' daughter. We might back up a little bit from the reading that was given by Ben to understand a little bit about what has happened just prior to our reading in Mark 5. Jesus has just gotten off the boat. He took a trip across the Sea of Galilee, and he gets stopped as he gets off the boat by a man named Jairus. Jairus is the ruler of the synagogue, as we understand it, which means that he had a position of power and influence in his community, likely a wealthy individual, an individual with a lot of religious importance. But he's really struggling because his daughter is sick. She's dying. And he comes and he literally throws himself at Jesus' feet, down on his hands and knees, and begs Jesus, "Please, come to my house. My daughter is dying. Please, lay your hands on her so that she may live." Jesus agrees and starts his way to the house. And it's a little bit of a journey to get from there to Jairus' house. And on the way, he gets stopped by a woman that has another health issue. While the crowds are pressing around Jesus going through town, a woman reaches out and touches Jesus' robe. A woman who had had an issue of blood for years and years. The doctors didn't know how to help her, had tried to treat her, and she couldn't find any solution for her health problems. Jesus heals her there. You might remember this story. Spend some time with her, talking to her. But by the time that situation has passed, Jairus gets another message. A messenger comes running up to him and shares the news that his daughter is now dead. Tells him not to bother the teacher anymore. They continue on their way to the house, but I can just imagine what was going through Jairus' mind as he's going to the house at this point. The guilt. Why wasn't I there? She died without me. I should have just stayed. I should have known that this wouldn't have worked out. Why did I even bother? Or I should have gotten there sooner. I should have left. I knew I should have left yesterday. Giving myself more time. I didn't give myself enough time. Or the anger. How could you, God? I'm a religious leader in your synagogue, your place of worship, and you can't do this for me? All these conflicting emotions as Jesus makes His way to the house with Jairus. And Jairus and He enter the house and they see firsthand the hopelessness of the situation. The mourners that are standing there gathered around the house and the family. In Jewish culture, it was common for after the death had occurred, for mourning to begin immediately. There was no planning period for the funeral. They buried their dead within days of dying because there was no preservation for the body. And so almost immediately the mourners show up. In fact, Jairus, being of wealth and power and influence, was able to hire mourners. If you read the passage in Matthew, the parallel account, we find that there were a lot of people gathered playing music and wailing loudly and making a display of their grief in front of the family. Which to us seems kind of odd, the obnoxiousness that this would have been for us to see. Because in our culture and society, if you go to a Waters funeral home for a death or a viewing or a funeral, it's very quiet, very somber. You pay your respects, you cry softly, you say I'm sorry gently, and you hug tenderly. It was not that way for grief in the first century. Grief was a very expressive time. Loud crying and wailing, playing of instruments and screaming, all sorts of things that to us seems rather obnoxious, but for them that was the way that they grieved. And Jesus even notes this when He comes up to the house. If you were paying attention when Ben was reading that, He says something to the effect of, "Why are you making all this commotion? The child's not dead, but sleeping." It's kind of an odd thing to say, isn't it? A child has just died. You know, of all the things that might be seen as insensitive to say, that might be one, because clearly in the people's mind that are observing this, that this child is indeed dead. We saw her die, Jesus. We were here. And so they laugh. But Jesus is undeterred. He asks everyone to leave, dismisses everyone from the house, and gathers the mother and the father, along with three of His closest disciples, Peter, James, and John, and they go into the child's room. He takes the child by the hand and tells her in Aramaic, "Little child, I say to you, arise." She rises. And the parents are shocked in amazement. Their little girl has just been raised from the dead. And Jesus says something which I laugh every time I read it. He does this a couple times in the Gospels when He does something miraculous like this. He says, "Don't tell anybody." You ever laugh? It's like, really, Jesus? You don't want us to say anything about this. Just keep it hush hush. Yeah, okay, sure. Like that's going to happen. But they walk away. A little girl risen from the dead. A father's grief overcome with joy. And I think about that story, and I think about all the things that we could talk about. What's significant about this story? Certainly we could discuss the father's grief and loss, the loss of a child. Those of us who have experienced that know the different kind of grief that that is. The hopelessness, the guilt that gets felt when you weren't able to do anything to save them. We could talk about Jesus' power over sickness and death. The fact that He displays this amazing show of power, supernatural power, not just with the original request of healing in sickness, but healing in death. But I think even more than these things, significant are the words that Jesus speaks to the crowd at the doorstep before He goes in the house. He says, "She is not dead, but sleeping." Death and sleep are often discussed in the same way in the Bible, in the New Testament especially. Jesus uses the term of sleeping for death in other places. In John 11, as He sees his best friend Lazarus dying. He tells his disciples that Lazarus is not dead, but asleep. In the passage we covered a few weeks ago in 1 Thessalonians, Paul tells the Thessalonian Christians that those of your loved ones who are in Christ have not died, but they're asleep. In fact, he mentions it several times through that passage, trying to help them understand that these people will live again. And it seems to be a fitting way to describe those who have died in the Lord as asleep. A couple weeks ago, Hannah, Abby and I went to Virginia to be with her family for vacation. Thanksgiving's in a couple months. You can tell where my mind is. So we went to be with them. We rented a condo, and you know, each of us had rooms there spread out through the condo, something you need to know about my wife's family is there's three daughters, Abby, Bethany, and Chloe. And Abby and Bethany are closer in age. Chloe's a bit younger than the rest of them. And I remember Chloe, when we started dating, Abby and I, Chloe was like in middle school or something, and I would go over to the family's house for weekend visits, and it was always comical because Chloe was always the last person awake on a Saturday morning. Without fail, Grant and Jill had to usually rouse her from her sleep somewhere before lunchtime, usually, because she would have missed it if they didn't wake her up. And she's gotten better since then, but she has continually been the one who sleeps the latest in the family when we go places and do things together. On the other end of the spectrum, however, is my daughter, who, without fail, is the first one awake in the house, in our house as well. For example, this morning, it was 6:30 in the morning, she was singing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star in her bed to herself, very happily sitting there when I walked in. And so you can imagine the angst for a young girl who is waiting very, very patiently for her Aunt Coco, as she calls her, to get out of bed in the morning. She loves her Aunt Coco. Aunt Coco plays with her and spends all the time in the world and spoils her rotten. And so it was funny every day of our vacation to watch and try to restrain Hannah from going in and waking up Aunt Coco. But at some point, as the morning got later, we released Faith, who is the other my niece, Bethany's daughter, and Hannah. We released the two minions to go wake up Aunt Coco. And it was funny because they would walk in the room and do all this stuff. And, you know, how can you be mad when you're getting woken up by two-year-olds? Not really. You can't be. So it was funny. But I sat there and thought about this parallelism between sleeping and death. And how as Christians we call death in some way, shape, or form being asleep. Because there's an expectation that at some point they will awaken. There's an expectation that at some point Hannah will get to see Aunt Coco again when she goes in to wake her up in the morning. And how we too think about the end of time when we are reunited with our loved ones and we get to see them again because they are indeed asleep. Jesus is really doing something that we're familiar with in psychology called reframing. In the 1960s, a psychologist by the name of Aaron Beck came up with this term, reframing. He worked a lot with patients who were dealing with depression, with negative thoughts, and he developed a method of therapy in which the person, he would try to imagine a different possibility for the person's negativity and their situation. And he would encourage his patients to think about things that were typically seen as negative in their life and see them as more positive. And so you might say something like this, if the patient is saying, "I'm so depressed. I can't believe it. It rained every day on our trip to the beach this summer." Now, I'm a beach guy, so when it rains every day on vacation for a beach vacation, that's a bad vacation. I mean, you know, sitting inside watching the rain while you're wanting to be outside, playing in the sand is not a fun time. However, you might say instead, "You know what, I'm really glad this trip, I got to spend a lot more time with my family playing some games and getting to visit one-on-one with them. Or instead of saying, I hit a car, or I hit a deer with my car, you might say, I needed a bigger vehicle anyway. We were getting ready to sell it. Those of you who are laughing know that's a little bit of a personal story. Or you might say something like, instead of I lost my job, you know, I've been thinking about making a career change. Now, I know this sounds, to those of you who are maybe a little bit more cynical like myself, this sounds like, yeah, right, you know, sure. That sounds really rosy and all sunshine and rainbows, doesn't it? And it does become more difficult the harder the situation is. And I don't mean to say that we can just glibly pass away death like we do getting hit by a deer or having a rainy beach vacation. But we can still do this. And we do it. Have you ever stood at a funeral home and said something like, I'm so glad they're not suffering anymore? Or they're at peace now? Or they're finally able to see mom and dad now? We do this already in death. We try to reframe the discussion to become more positive, to deal with the emotions of ourselves a little bit more easily. It doesn't take away the pain. It doesn't mean that we don't experience grief. But we do see things differently. And so we say, see you later, instead of goodbye. We say, they're experiencing life now, instead of death. We say, we'll see them again soon. Or they beat us there. These kinds of expressions and phrases, it is all about reframing death. And Jesus does the same thing. He says, I tell you, she's not dead. She's asleep. So as we close out this series on death, we think about how to discuss death. And death is a difficult topic to talk about. Some people don't want to talk about it at all. Some people want to talk about it and deal with it. But as Christians, we have the opportunity and the ability to talk about it differently than the world. Because we can truly reframe the discussion on death. My grandparents, many of you know this, I've shared this before, last year and a half, both grandparents on my dad's side passed away within a year of each other. One was expected, the other was not. One of my best memories of my grandparents on that side was going over to their house in the summers and playing cowboys and Indians. My grandfather would dress up like a cowboy and we'd play Roy Rogers. My grandmother would be Dale Evans and I would be Roy Rogers. Pop-up would usually be the bad guy or somebody else. But we would do these things, and we would watch Roy Rogers episodes. It was one of our favorite pastimes. And if you've ever watched a Roy Rogers episode or been interested in Roy Rogers and Dale Evans at all, you remember the end of every episode was the same. Right? The credits would roll, and their song, Happy Trails, the chorus would play. As they ride off to the camera, Dale Evans and Roy Rogers would sing their duet, Happy Trails. And the lyrics would go, Happy Trails to you until we meet again. Happy Trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Happy Trails to you until we meet again. Since my grandparents have died, that chorus has meant more to me than it ever had growing up. Because truly, we can say, until we meet again, keep smiling until then. Happy trails to you. So how do you reframe your discussion on death? What are the things that you could say in the face of death of your loved ones that you hope to see again? Only you can answer that question. But this morning, we have the opportunity and the ability as Christians to reframe the discussion. Just a minute, we're going to have an invitation song. And Bob's going to come up and sing a song. And if you need to respond in any way, if we can help you through grief, responding to the message that we're talking about, or if today would be the day that you decide, hey, I want to have this hope. I don't know that I would see my loved ones again if I passed tomorrow. We want to share that hope with you this morning. If we can do anything for you, please let us know as we stand and sing this song.